I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Wednesday morning, we take a deep dive into crime and policing, as we do every Wednesday, with Ronald Serpas, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville State Police, consultant to many departments, and you'll see him on TV occasionally as they want an expert to talk to, be it on network or cable TV. How you doing, Chief?
I'm wonderful, Tommy. You doing well today?
I am doing okay. It's beautiful weather. How can you not be doing great, right?
I agree with you. It would be impossible not to be doing well.
Let's talk about departments and not doing well budget-wise, and what it's like to run a department when you're under a budget crunch, because you heard Ann Kirkpatrick saying, if you want me to run it without overtime, I'm not your person, et cetera, et cetera. Take me from there, Chief.
Well, I think it's basically this. Your budget is just like your household budget. You get X amount of dollars, and you can only spend what you have. In the case of being a police chief, you have the components here in New Orleans. I don't think the police department has ever recovered from the staffing changes that had to occur during 2010 and 2018.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that. Let me interrupt for a second, because I saw a story that talked about the budget crunch that Mayor Landrieu faced and how he put a hiring freeze on NOPD. And I thought about the many conversations you and I had about how they never recovered from that. So then I got to thinking about, well, was that a good thing that he did or a bad thing that he did in terms of managing the budget? So I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you that.
Well, I mean, I think it's very true and clear. We were all in it together in 10, 11, and 12. The budget was just completely in disarray from issues that occurred before Landrieu took office. Mm-hmm. However, because we froze hiring for so long, which was a city decision supported by the city council, I certainly didn't think it was the right idea. It takes so long to hire people. So here we are all these short years later, and the department's around 900 people, where in May of 2010, it was 1,650 people. So it's essentially been cut by almost half. By the time I left, when total employment was considered, we'd lost about 25% of the department in 4 years. It takes a long time to recover from that, and clearly I don't think the city's recovered yet, honestly, because we've had 8 years of Cantrell, we had the second 4 years of Landrieu, and we still have a department that's half of what it was in 2010 with a citizen demand that's not changed appreciably. People are still calling the police all day, every day. So that speaks to your first question. If you have 800 or 900 people and you're trying to meet the workload demand of what 1,200 people would need or 1,300 people, you generally are going to have to use overtime to make up that difference. People expect a quick response. The other thing that people expect is a competent criminal investigation. Those units usually take up 25 to 30% of your staff and about 20% of your budget. So all these things get compressed when you don't have money. And third, Tommy, the men and women of the New Orleans Police Department and departments we see all over the country, as we've consulted with 30 or 40 departments in the last couple of years, it exhausts the workforce. Overtime is meant for unexpected or planned events that are short-lived or unexpected events that just happened. But when you're using overtime every single day to fill the basic core responsibilities, you will exhaust the workforce. An exhausted workforce is not safe for the officer's health. It's not safe for their ability to provide service. And it's just a continuation of a degradation that the city has unable to have been changed since late 2010.
Back in the day when you were, what did you start with the department, Chief?
1980.
Okay, so 1980. Were two-person units an anomaly then, or was that the way it normally worked? I was just wondering how many officers they had on the force then.
It was always a mixture. From the very first day I worked as a police officer, there were one-person cars and a shorter number of two-person cars. That's not unusual in the country. It's the way to do business. The state troopers ride by themselves every day, all day. Mm-hmm. Sheriffs ride by themselves every day, all day. There's a lot of reasons why it's a good thing to do. I still think it's a good thing to do. You have circumstances.
Wait, why? What's a good thing to do?
One officer patrol.
Okay.
One officer patrol is the preferred method. When you need more than one officer, you send more than one officer. But that's not new. That's been going on for the 45 years since I've been here.
Because you watch the old TV shows, I don't know what made me think of this, and they got,
one
you know,
out of 12.
Right, yeah, and they got two officers in a unit, and you never see that anymore, do you? They found out that it would be more efficient to do it with just one person?
Absolutely. You will still have some cases where you'll have two officers, right? If you have a field training officer and a new person, that would obviously be a two-person car. And in some circumstances, you might want to staff a two-person car because you have a number of calls that require that, so you put two people in one car. But the main method of delivering police service in America, not exclusively, but the main method is one-person units.
All right, let's talk about right-sizing when we come back. Ron will surpass our guest, mm-hmm. Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. What's the right number of officers? How do you draw the line between the right number or supplanting it with overtime or exhausting the force? 821 traffic now, WWL. 826 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Ronald Surpass, Professor of Practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD Superintendent, Washington State Police, Nashville City Police. So, Chief, when it comes to right-sizing the department, you and I have had this conversation numerous times. How do you know what the right number is? Because you got budgetary considerations. You don't want to wear out or exhaust the force, as you said, with the use of overtime. You can't count on overtime because something liable to happen where you don't have enough officers, overtime or not, to take care of it. Take me through this this Rubik's Cube, if you will.
Well, and what happens is if you have overtime and you're using it extensively, which may be the case here as being public reports, the minute it ends, it's a shock to the system. Right. I mean, if you've been using overtime to supplement
to the officer system you're talking about or to the
community.
OK,
to the community.
All right.
And certainly the officers in one way, but the community, which had been getting a supplemented response by overtime when the overtime ends, which it's probably going to very quickly, then that becomes an immediate jolt to the system, to the citizens who are going to be experiencing much longer times in reporting crimes. We also know historically, academically, and practitioners know that when the police are slow to respond, people will stop to call. It'll just kill the calls for service desire on the part of the community because they don't think they're getting anything in response. Those are very bad things to be in. So overtime does not allow you to give a consistent, reliable service that's not triggered by, oh, we have no more overtime, so that means 20% or 30% of our response time is going to be tanked because we don't have it. Those are estimates, or guesses, I should say. Secondly, when you look at a workload analysis, you don't just look at whether or not you think this number of people can do the job. You actually got to dig down into the weeds. How long are officers spending on what types of calls? How many officers? How much free time do they have to do proactive policing, Tommy, which is the only form of policing scientifically proven to work? Hotspot proactive policing reduces crime, period, the end. Community policing does not generally reduce crime. It increases citizen satisfaction, but it doesn't reduce crime. What reduces crime is having time in the day after a careful workload analysis to say, Tommy, Ronnie, y'all got 40% of your day free today. This particular 1% of the street segments is where all the shootings are happening. Go there, meet people, walk, knock on doors, give a presence. That works, Tommy.
Let me just interrupt for a second. What does that mean, knock on doors, meet people? You got 40% of your workday. You want to do some hotspot proactive policing. This is where the crime's happening. As an officer, what are you doing then? What would you be expected to do?
It's any number of things. It's got to be closely supervised, but it could be walking beats, just reestablishing the presence, making connections with people. It could be looking for warrant offenders who might be in the area. It could be doing undercover operations on narcotics and violent crime interdiction. But we know that in New Orleans, there's only a handful of streets where most of the problem is, just like anywhere in America. Hotspot policing is just that. Micro focus on those particular spots and do it in a way that's constitutionally sound and aggressive. It can reduce crime. It doesn't move it around the corner either. It reduces it.
Generally speaking, and as a former officer, I don't know if it's two different questions or not, but would you want as much overtime as you could get, or does the average officer want as much overtime as they can get? Because I know in different occupations, some people want as much overtime as they can get to make as much money as they can. Other people say, no, I want the time off.
Well, I'll tell you this. We've done 30 or 40 cities in the country in the last 9 years, and we are seeing more officers wanting more time off and less being forced to work overtime. That is a change, and that's an important thing to remember when you're trying to motivate people to get the job done. So relying on overtime exhausts people, and younger people are generally not interested in working the overtime. So it's a compounding problem. You got to get staff up. That's just period, the end. So it's not unusual anywhere that we've worked around the country to find officers.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Deferring overtime and taking compensatory time off if they can. They want to have a life. They want to have a life outside of the police department, and that is not unusual. And that's a good thing for those people. Why would we be against it? You have to have staffing to overcome that. So in any department, if you're trying to work people 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, you're going to wear them out, and you're going to wear out their opportunity to be successful in their professional life and their personal life.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time as always. Ronald Serpas, we'll take a break, come back, talk about pogey boats in Menhaden right now. 8:31, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Eno's Inn. All right, 8:47, quickly to Joe Ogeron, Louisiana State Representative, who happens to be a physicist, to talk about pogey and Menhaden. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. You hear me all right?
Yes, sir. I can hear you fine. Let's talk about Menhaden and pogey. Same thing? Interchangeable?
Same thing.
Okay.
Two flavors. There's an Atlantic species up that they catch near Virginia. They've had issues up there. Their sports fish of choice is what's called the striped bass. And then there's the Gulf variant of Menhaden down here. And, of course, all the things that we love down here, redfish, trout, everything else, is where the stakeholder conflict is coming from.
Yeah, where's the controversy come in? Where's the conflict?
The controversy is, of course, always industrial-sized vessels and industrial reduction Menhaden industry coming so close to the shores and the beach. Menhaden is a pelagic species, an ocean-going fish. Every year they say the Menhaden industry is not overfished. They barely touch 2%, meaning 98% of them in the Gulf are left perfectly fine, so we're not overfishing them. Problem is they're coming all the way up to very, very shallow waters, and they're basically doing what we call isolated depletion. They're taking Menhaden from the sport coastal species that we rely on here in Sportsman's Paradise. So the conflict's always been, how far back should they be off the coast to still be able to catch their quota of Menhaden to supply for omega-3 fish oil and fish protein and food and fertilizer and all the things that they use the protein for, and still try to minimize the effect on those coastal species that we recreationally love to catch and fish here in Louisiana.
Do humans eat these things at all, pogies?
Absolutely not. They are inedible for humans. They're a bony, oily, little 6-inch fish.
No way to process them to feed hungry people or anything like that?
No, not at all. They're ground up whole, and they come out into, they make three things: water, pure water that they're able to put back into the ecosystem, an oil, omega-3 oil that goes exactly into the supplements that we all take for our heart, healthy heart, and a solid brown powder, which is a fish meal protein that goes into many, many different things. Pet foods, alligator feed, crawfish bait, fish food. And I don't mean the flakes you put in your aquarium. I'm talking about fish food, that little pellets that feed fish forms.
So if you
that's what it goes into.
If 98% of the Menhaden survive out in the Gulf, it would seem to me to make every bit of sense, not being in the Menhaden industry, to say, well, you know what, you guys have to spend a little bit more on gas, but they have plenty of Menhaden out there. Go get them. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong.
Okay.
But if you ever had to try to catch a wild animal, you know, in the middle of a field, it's always easier up against a fence line.
I got
you. So if you could get them in the shallow waters, that's basically what they're doing, and as cost-effectively and as profitably as humanly possible.
But would it be, because in other areas, well, let me take you through this. What about other areas? Is the Menhaden industry more popular off the coast of Louisiana or in Louisiana because of the fact that we let them get so close to the shore as opposed to other states?
Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas have all seen the writing on the wall and have all done common sense legislation to keep them either in Florida. I think it's a complete ban. They don't allow the type of net gear that's used, which is called the purse seine there. And Alabama, Mississippi have buffers that they keep them about a mile off the coast in somewhat deeper water to use this particular type of net gear so it doesn't touch the seafloor. And Texas has common sense regulation in the form of a quota that only lets them take a very small amount out of their waters. Louisiana, Wild, Wild West. Go, go for it.
So is that because of the political influence that I could, you know, I read the story and I can make a case where, okay, Louisiana doesn't have the beaches and they're not as concerned as is, say, the other states, Florida or Mississippi or Alabama or Texas, or is it about political influence that the menhaden industry has, and how big of an employer are they, Joe?
They're, you know, they probably have, I would say, 1,000 people, you know, two companies, both foreign-owned, that hire Americans because of the Jones Act. They have to do that with American sailors and mariners. But I think in each one of the two companies in three locations, it's about 300 people. So altogether, you're talking about 1,000 people.
So we had worked a thing out where they had made the buffer zone, they did a bycatch study, et cetera, et cetera. Where do we stand now with all of this?
Well, you know, I had ran legislation to start at a one-mile buffer, similar to some of the other states. Was told I needed to compromise, get it down to a half mile. That unfortunately failed, and I was unable to get any, you know, it basically politically it got killed. Then a couple of years later, they had net tear accidents and put a whole bunch of dead fish, both redfish and menhaden, on the beach in Holly Beach. And the Wildlife and Fisheries Commission stepped up and basically said, we're going to have you at a 1 mile buffer. And that was getting ready to go into effect. And, we had a change in the administration. The governor appointed some different people into the commissioner's board, the Wildlife and Fishery Commission. And then all of a sudden, that half mile, we were told you needed to compromise back to from the 1 mile to a half mile. And that's where it's been. And we've been at a kind of a laissez-faire of saying, you know, as long as y'all don't have any major disruptions at a half mile, and y'all abide by that buffer, we'll kind of not run any more legislation against y'all. And that's where we've been up until recently. Recently, they did put in for a request to erode the buffer. So that's where we're at now.
We'll talk to you again. We'll watch how this happens, how it proceeds. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate your time. Joe Ogeron, Louisiana State Representative, who happens to be a physicist as well. 854. And an adjunct professor of some other things. Plus, he used the word pelagic, which should get him a coffee mug, but we don't have any more because he improved the vocabulary of the audience. 854 Traffic, WWL.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.